Got to get through me first, Liz.
Does it matter if I'm from Orchid?
No. I'd like to introduce our speaker from Orchid, California. That's now.
Yeah, that's now. Thank you. My name's Erica. I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Erica.
Thank you, Stan, for asking me to be here. This is really amazing to me because I never in my wildest dreams imagined that I would be able to stand up in front of people and talk without this secret inside of me that that you couldn't know about. I didn't imagine I'd be able to get up and speak in front of people without having had a few nips before. And then, of course, the shame of that I would have to hide from you while I was talking to you. So the freedom that this program has given me never ceases to wow me. So anyway, so I do want to start with the basics, and that is I have a sobriety date, which is May 30th, 2007. I have a sponsor, and I have regularly scheduled meetings that I go to every week without fail. And I think it's important for, there's a lot of newcomers in this room, and when I mentioned sponsorship, my sponsor that I have today is not the one I started with, and it doesn't, I had the privilege of going to detox and then rehab, and before I left rehab, they wanted us to have a sponsor. Well, I didn't know anyone. I knew one woman through work that I knew went to AA, and I called her, happened to have her number, and I called her and asked her for some women's numbers, and she gave me two numbers. The first woman I called said she couldn't because she was only in Santa Maria part-time. She lived in another state part of the year. And the second woman I called said, yes, she would sponsor me. And so I didn't know this woman. It's not like I had to sit in meetings and connect with someone. She, thank God for her, because she was a woman that had worked the 12 steps. Sobriety was her number one priority. She lived by the principles of this program, and she was willing to tell me the truth. And that's all I needed, was someone that was willing to give to me what had been given to her. And so if you're new and you've been putting off getting a sponsor, you don't need to put it off. Just, you don't need to find the perfect sponsor. Someone, a man or woman that has worked these steps, that makes sobriety or recovery their number one priority and is willing to call you on your bullshit, is what I needed. And so I would encourage you to do that as soon as possible. So I'm going to try to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. Donna wants some dirt, so we'll see. I think it's also important for people to know that, you know what, I grew up in a really nice family, a really upper middle class, nice family. I can look back now and see that my brother, my older brother, who really, really didn't want me to be a part of the family, probably contributed to the part of my not feeling like I fit in. You know, he told me when I was 5 that I was adopted from an Indian reservation, and I believed it, and so every time he'd tell me that, I'd cry, and so he said my name was Linawika Rain in the Face, and it all made sense because they had gone skiing, and they had to come through an Indian reservation to get back, and so it made sense to me. So there was that feeling that I didn't fit in, but I don't think that's what made me an alcoholic, because I think from the very first time I drank alcoholically. For me, it was to the effect. It was to drink to get drunk. I have never in my entire life had a drink just to have a social drink. I don't know if any of you have, if you like maybe progressed to the point of alcoholism, but for me, there was never a time when it was, let's just have a beer, or let's just have a glass of wine. For me, the whole purpose behind drinking was to get drunk. And obviously from the time I was 12 years old, I didn't have an opportunity to drink every day, but I certainly was thinking about the next time I could drink. And so, and from what I understand, normal people don't think like that. I do know in high school, well, even before high school, that I'm going to have to talk about drugs because they're really definitely a part of my story. In high school, it was either getting drunk or whatever we could get our hands on. Anything to alter our state of mind. And so if you had it and were willing to share it with me, I would take it. It really didn't matter what it was. And you know, today I'm thankful that some of the drugs that are out there now weren't available then because I would have done them. And then luckily because I had this nice family with a little bit of, you know, extra income, I quickly learned that I could actually purchase some things and then people would want to be around me. They'd want to hang out with me. So now I had friends and I didn't feel quite so left out anymore, even though, you know, drugs and alcohol gave me this sense of, you know, bravado that I was all powerful and I was cuter than I was. I was thinner than I was. I had friends when I really didn't. Being the go-to person was really important to me. One of the things I had when I got my driver's license, my second car was a 57 Chevy four-door sedan. Nice car. And of course, if you'll remember, they had these great big steering wheels. Well, my friend Cynthia and I went out drinking. We were supposed to be at the drive-in or something, and we went out drinking, and all we had vodka, but all we had to mix it with was grape soda. Well, I got really drunk and really sick, and Cynthia had to drive. And now she was only about this tall, right? So she's driving, looking through the steering wheel, and I'm hanging out the door of the car, throwing up. And I was so sick, and I remember thinking, you know what, I will never, ever drink grape soda again. And I swear to you, to this day, I have never had grape soda again. That's the kind of alcoholic I am. You know, when I left Santa Maria and went to San Diego for to go to college, and you know, somehow I managed to keep it kind of together. I could consume mass quantities of drugs and alcohol, but I managed to be able to show up for class usually. I managed to be able to get okay grades. I even managed to be able to get a job. Of course, I found in San Diego, cocaine had just come on the scene. And so I found that there was a little way to boost my income, you know, I didn't have to. And again, it made me really popular. It made me, like, people wanted to hang around with me, and that was really important to me. And so, but, you know, waking up or coming to in the morning with, like, these huge, you know, like these two long gashes on the inside of my leg and only a brief recall of a chain link fence, you know, that was just normal to me. You know, drinking or using to the capacity of blacking out or not remembering until the next day, kind of trying to piece together, to me, that was just a normal consequence of someone that likes to party the way I do. That's how I like to party. That's how I did from the first time I drank to the last time I drank. Those were just normal consequences. So to me, you know, that I was able to hold it together as much as I did is just, it's remarkable. I kept changing schools and majors when I was in college because every time it would get to look a little bit like work, and I didn't realize this until later on looking back, but every time it would start to look a little bit like work or that my school, the career path that I was taking was going to interfere with my partying, I'd switch schools, and I'd decide, oh, okay, now I'm going to be a pre-med major, so I'll do that for 2 years, and then, oops, and then when it came time to do the next thing, oh, I'm going to be a graphics major now, I'm going to change and do something different, and, you know, but the partying in between time never stopped. And it was like this. You know, I lived in this great city, San Diego, and Mission Beach was a lot of fun. And we would go to the bars on the weekends and just drink ridiculous amounts of alcohol. And I remember one time going out to the beach. On Mission Bay, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but they have these nice fire rings all along the beach where families gather and stuff. And my friend Sherry and I are walking, and I tell Sherry that I need to go to the bathroom, and she says, well, you know, just squat on the fire ring. And I thought, okay, that sounds good. And, you know, about the time I'm getting ready to go pee, I kind of glance up and realize, you know, it's the middle of the day, and there's families out here, and I'm thinking, well, maybe this isn't such a good idea. So, I mean, that's kind of the insanity of the way I party. When I came back to from San Diego to Santa Maria, well, I had come back because by that point, everybody that I knew in college was actually graduating and moving on with their lives. And I didn't do that. So I found different kinds of people, and one of whom was, let's just put it nicely. I don't know how to put it nicely. He was an ex-con. What he did was he and his buddy would go to houses where drug deals were going down, and they would tape up they'd go in with guns, and they would tape up the buyer and the seller and steal both the money and the product. And when it got a little too hot, he suggested that we leave and go to Puerto Rico. I thought this was a great idea. I love to travel and be adventurous, and I was, you know, it was getting a little risky driving the getaway car for them, so I had a tax return, we bought a plane ticket, we went to Puerto Rico. As soon as we got there, of course, he ditched me, because he got where he needed to be, and I was kind of all alone. But, you know, it never occurred to me there was anything wrong with that. I just got on a plane, flew over to St. Thomas, called my folks, said, listen, I have a job lined up, can you send me some money? They said, no, we'll send you a plane ticket. I couldn't cash that in, so I came back to Santa Maria with 64 cents in my pocket, and it didn't seem crazy to me at all. It just seemed, you know, like this was an adventure I was on. It didn't stop there. I came back to Santa Maria, continued drinking and using. In fact, Steve was one of my best customers here in Santa Maria. Imagine my surprise when I walked through the doors of AA and saw him sitting here. Yeah, there was a place on, a lot of you will remember Broadway and Donovan, called Alexander's Harvest, and they used to have great bands, and yeah. In fact, now that I talk about that, I remember one night, being there drinking, and this is the insanity of my disease. Okay, I've been drinking all night. Someone gives me, I think, a Quaalude or something like that. So I take that. That's fine. And then this other guy says, he's too wasted to drive home. Can I give him a ride? No problem. He lives in Los Alamos. So, you know, I've been drinking all night, just took a Quaalude, and I'm going to give this guy a ride home. And that night, I owned a Volkswagen van. But that night it was in the shop, and I was driving my dad's El Camino. So I take this guy to Los Alamos. I'm on my way back coming down Miller Street. I get to the intersection of Cook and Miller, and I fell asleep at the wheel. Went through the intersection. At that time there was a median with trees in the middle. I took out that first tree and came to and tried to reverse. But that didn't work. The car was pretty much totaled. And, of course, I was only half a block from the police station. So they were there quickly. And, you know, that was my second DUI. In my mind, it was not my fault. I was not too loaded. What the problem was that I was in my dad's El Camino with a heater on, and I was all laid back and comfortable. If I'd been in my Volkswagen van, I'd been sitting up straight. It wouldn't have been so warm and cozy. I would have been more alert. It had nothing to do with the fact that I was completely wasted out of my mind. It had everything to do with the car I was driving. It didn't slow me down. That was my second DUI. It cost a little more money and cost a little more time, but it didn't slow me down at all. When my daughter, after my daughter was born, at that point, it was called Crank back then. And I was selling it in mass quantities. And it occurred to me, now I had this small child, that maybe I needed to stop doing drugs. I didn't know about AA or NA. I didn't know about detox. I didn't know about rehab. I didn't know about any of that stuff. I told my daughter's father, I need to stop using drugs. I'm going to lay on the couch and sleep. And that's what I did for a week. I slept for a week. And then I knew at that point that I couldn't do anything because I had an addictive personality. And if I did any drugs after that, I would get hooked again. So I never used again. That was 24 years ago. But I didn't quit drinking because that was normal, socially acceptable. I come from a Swiss-Italian family. We have a glass of wine with dinner. You know, it's totally acceptable. And so I continued drinking. And I did manage to, you know, have another child, have kind of what looked like a normal life. But as the years went by, it just got worse and worse and worse, and I got sicker and deader inside. Eventually what happened was my family started complaining that I was like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I didn't understand it because to me it's like I came home, I worked hard. I managed, you know, I had a full-time job, managed the house, bought the groceries, took care of the kids. They were always at soccer or baseball practice on time. I did everything. Of course I deserved a drink when I got home. And, you know, they'd walk in and say something to me and suddenly I was upset. And of course it wasn't my fault because I was, you know, had a half pint of vodka already. It was obviously their fault for not appreciating me. And so they started complaining about me, about my, I might have a problem with alcohol. And, you know, it occurred to me about 3 years prior to that, that maybe I was drinking a little more than, or maybe I wasn't drinking normally, that maybe I was an alcoholic. When we went camping one time and we're all sitting around the campfire and everybody's drinking and I go into the motorhome and I poured another bunch of vodka in my glass, sneaking, so no one would see. And I remember feeling like I was sneaking and hiding it from the rest of the group. But in my mind, I rationalized that, you know, I was always able to consume a lot more alcohol than my friends. So I just needed that extra to keep up with them because they were getting too drunk too fast and I needed to keep up with them, right? So that, but it didn't bother me a little bit that maybe I might have a problem with alcohol. And, and I should back up and say this. After that second DUI, the judge suggested I go to AA and I got a court card and I went to an AA meeting and I stood at the door and I looked inside and I went, no, this is not for me. These people are not my kind of people. This is not going to work. And that was in 1985. And I just shut the door on the idea of AA at that point. I knew it was not an option for me. So when I had that revelation that maybe I had a problem with alcohol, it never occurred to me to go to an AA meeting. A few years later, when I had, you know, normal routine, came home, probably had a little bit to drink on the way home, because I was really clever. Now I put it in my water bottles in my car so that my family wouldn't know that I drank as much as I did, because, you know, I could have two glasses of wine with dinner. Everybody did, but, of course, that for me, that wasn't enough. So my daughter comes in. She says something. I go crazy, like my pity party, and I said, I run up the stairs, that's it, I'm just going to kill myself, I'll get the gun. And of course, we had a gun, I didn't know where the bullets were or anything, but you know, I was just being the drama queen. Well, Katie called 911 and I got 5150, so in San Luis. And the only way I could get out of there the next day, and I'll tell you, that was not a really nice place, but anyway, the only way I could get out of there the next day is if I promised I would go to an AA meeting. So my first AA meeting, legit AA meeting, was December 14th, 2005 at the Five Cities Group in Arroyo Grande. And, you know, I don't remember very much about that meeting, but I do remember that I came away with the feeling that there might be a way for me to stop drinking. There was some hope there. I continued to go to meetings every day. Of course, I would kind of sneak in and sneak out. I read the book a couple of times. I started talking the talk. I thought AA was it was good. I liked it. It made a lot of sense. I related to, you know, chapter 3 in the book. I was like, oh, that's what it is. That's me. And, but you know, I'm pretty smart, and I figured that I could do the AA thing over here and then just keep doing my life the way I wanted to do it over here. And my husband at the time, he didn't have a problem with alcohol, so he wasn't willing to stop drinking to support me, but the agreement was that he was going to have it outside in the shop. Well, he didn't have it outside in the shop. He had it in his office, and like any good alcoholic, I could smell it. When he would pour a drink, 10 minutes later, I knew it was in the room. So I found it, and I thought, I'm going to prove that I can drink like a normal person. So I went and took a swig off of, after about 5 months of sobriety, I took a swig off that bottle. I was so proud of myself because I had one drink, and I didn't have another drink for a whole week. I was like, aha, this AA really works. I can now drink like a normal person. And a week later, I had another drink off that bottle, and I thought, I'll have two, just so I can get a little buzz, and then that'll be it. And I did that, and I was so proud of myself because, again, I didn't have another drink for a whole week. And for a daily drinker, that was huge. Well, you probably can guess that it didn't take long for me to be drinking every day again. And I did that same routine for the next year, in and out of AA, trying to drink. It says, we read that portion of chapter 3, and in the very next section, it says we tried every form of self-deception and experimentation to prove we could drink like normal people. That's what I did for a year. I tried everything I could think of to drink like a normal person. Memorial Day weekend in 2007, after a four-day blackout, I had been in an outpatient program, called the coordinator, said, I can't come to group tonight, I've been drunk for 4 days, and I went into my little pity party about they'd all be better off without me. He says, Erica, don't say that. I said, it's true, they'd be better off without me. We hung up the phone, he called my husband, said, take her to the hospital, get her checked out, and take her to 5 East in Santa Barbara, which is what happened. I had a 0.34 blood alcohol level when I was at Arroyo Grande Hospital. I'm still coherent. I mean, I was embarrassed. I pulled the sheet up over my head so no one would look at me. But that's the kind of alcohol that I can consume. I got to 5 East, and I really enjoyed the Ativan that they give you there. And even when I didn't need it anymore, I told them, maybe I need some more. I had to wait till a bed opened up at Cottage Residential, and so after about 5 days, I got into CRC. And, you know, when I got there, I was done. I realized that I had tried everything I could think of to figure out how to stop drinking, and I couldn't. I was out of ideas. I had no other choice but to just surrender and say, okay, I'll do whatever you tell me to do. The only thing I could do at that point was just pray to be willing, just pray for willingness. I had had a God in my life, a concept of God, prior to that. I mean, I went to church every Sunday. It made it look good. We were a nice, wholesome family, right? I go to church every Sunday, drive out of the parking lot, and drink my vodka out of my water bottle. I was in the church choir, so of course it looked good. But I didn't have a relationship with that God, not the kind I have today. Anyway, I knew I had put up a wall between me and God, because if I got too close to God, it was going to interfere with my drinking. And so my first prayer was for God to come into my life, to just creep back into my life and let me be willing to do this thing. I have to say, I was scared to death. After 35 years of drinking and using every day of my life, I had no clue how I was going to live life without alcohol. I had no idea how I was going to go to work, how I was going to take care of the house, how I was going to do anything without alcohol. I had never done it before. I cried for the first week in rehab, And then I got comfortable, but I'll tell you what, I absorbed everything those people said. I listened so intently at every meeting because I realized I just was out of ideas. I didn't have any other options. Like I said, I had that lady who sponsored me, who said she would sponsor me, meet me when I got back. And I'd worked the first three steps in rehab, so I told her I was desperate to work the fourth step. Would she let me? And she said, sure. And then I proceeded to tell her how, you know, I was so fragile and my husband is so mean and he's really abusive and, you know, that's one of my big triggers. And she looked at me across the table at Denny's and she said, honey, I completely understand. She says, but he's not your problem. Alcohol's your problem. I was like, oh, shit. It's not going to work on her. Yeah. She called me on it that first day. And I'll tell you what, that's exactly what I needed. I needed someone willing to call me on my bullshit from the very get-go. I got busy and I got those steps done. I was done with my steps in the first, like, 3 months of being back from rehab because I was desperate to stay sober. I knew I couldn't continue to drink like I was. And that first year I call it my sober fog because I really don't remember a whole lot about it except that I just made recovery my number one focus. I'd go to work, I'd come home, I'd make the dinner, I'd go to a meeting, I'd come home, I'd read the book, I'd work on my steps. My husband was kind of abusive. He was pretty mean, and he didn't like the fact that I was sober. He always said he wanted me to be sober, but he didn't really like it because he couldn't control and manipulate me the way he was used to when I was full of guilt and shame, or drunk. And so, but I had read a book on codependency while I was in rehab, which really helped me a lot. And when he would try to engage me in an argument or something, I'd say, gee, I'm sorry you feel that way. I love you. And I'd walk away. It probably saved my life that first year of recovery that I wouldn't, you know, go there. Because definitely those feelings were the feelings that I drank over a lot. So after I committed to a year to stay in that relationship for a year, and after, just prior to my 1 year, the kids and I left. And so that's what happened, and that's how I got to AA. I did continue to go to meetings in Napomo for a while because that's where I was living, but after I'd been here for about 6 months, I realized, you know what, I need to connect with the Santa Maria AA. So I came to this room, and even though I had like 18 months or so of sobriety, I acted like a newcomer. I started washing coffee cups. Offering to be of service in other meetings, being secretary. I did what I could to plug in and be a part of, because to me, my recovery has to come first. The rest of my life will happen as long as I stay sober. The rest of everything else I think I need to manage and control actually gets taken well care of as long as I just stay out of the way and stay sober. I realize today, that there's a lot more than my disease that I'm powerless over. You know, the first and most important thing I did when I got to that rehab is I finally admitted that I'm an alcoholic, and I was okay with it. I finally decided that it was okay to be an alcoholic. In one of the groups we went to, they asked us, you know, what is your picture of an alcoholic? And of course, my picture was the guy on Skid Row with the brown paper bag in the gutter. That's what an alcoholic looked like. Certainly someone that has a job and a nice car and a big house and boats and motorhomes, that can't be an alcoholic. But when I finally realized that this wasn't a moral issue, that I wasn't a bad person, that I had a disease, and I was okay with that, that's when I was able to begin this journey. When I finally was willing to, we just talked about this a few minutes ago, I had to work so hard to control everything in my environment so that I could drink the way I did. I had to make sure the dishwasher was loaded properly so that I could get it unloaded properly and get to my drinking right away. I had to make sure the kids were all, I had to make sure I was on church and in the choir and make sure everything looked good, everything was on schedule. I had to manage the house, everything, so that it looked normal to you, so that you wouldn't know how I drank. When I turned my will and my life over to the power of God as I understood Him, my God, what a relief. All of that, I didn't have to be in charge of the universe anymore. It was like I physically felt the weight being lifted off of me when I surrendered to this way of life. And, you know, I realize now, today, that I'm powerless over a lot of things, not just my disease. I'm powerless over your disease. I'm powerless over, you know, the cost of gas. I'm powerless over, I mean, to me today, it's like, I heard this on a cruise I was on recently. It's kind of like, what is my powerlessness du jour? You know, every day I realize that there's some, you know, I only have control over so much. And what I have control over today is my recovery. I can make that number one. And what I can do to stay in conscious contact with my higher power. That's the only hope I have. You know, in our book it says that there will come a day when we don't even know why. Unless we have conscious contact with our higher power, we'll reach for a drink and not even know why. We'll be drinking it before we realize what we're doing, unless we have our higher power working in our life. And I'm not going to say, I can't say that I never say, that it never occurs to me to drink. You know, for the first 2 years of my sobriety, I like to bake. I wouldn't allow real vanilla extract in my house because it's loaded with alcohol and it tastes wonderful. For me, I just love alcohol. I mean, I like the way it tastes. I like the way it makes me feel. I love everything about it. So I wouldn't have real vanilla extract in my house. I was making cookies probably 10 months ago or so, and I have a little ritual. I pour the vanilla extract in there, and then I go over to the sink, and I rinse the spoon out so that there's no temptation to lick it. And I could smell the alcohol in the vanilla extract, and I thought, oh, that smells so good. Gosh, I wish I could drink. And then I thought, and then my other side of my brain's going, no, no, you don't mean that. You don't want to drink. And I said, but you do want to drink. You love alcohol. It tastes so good. You like what it is. And my other side of my brain's going, no, no, you can't do that. So I'm having this argument with myself over the bowl of cookie dough. And I had to step back and go, okay, let's review. Here's my life with alcohol. Here's my life without. Okay, I think I got it now. You know, it's like I actually had to physically remove myself for a minute because, you know, this is a cunning, baffling, and powerful disease, and it wants to take me out. And unless I stay close to this program, do what I was instructed to do from the very beginning on a daily basis, I can never relax and think that, you know what, I got this now, because as soon as I do, I'm in big trouble. So, and yeah, so anyway, so I won't go into all of that, but anyway, so today my life is good. I'm usually pretty comfortable. I'm usually pretty happy, joyous, and free, if you will, because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have found friendships here, relationships that I never knew even existed. There's something about the common bond that we share. Don't you just love running into each other out in the public? Like, you know, I see Daniel, you know, at his work all the time, and I get a hug, you know? It's like, these are friendships that I never knew existed before. And even if I don't know you, maybe we don't hang out, if you needed help, I'd be there. Because this is a deadly disease, and I don't want to see anyone have to die that doesn't have to. The truth of the... I'll share something real personal. I have a child that is struggling with addiction, and I've spent years trying to fix and rescue, and, you know, in the name of support and help, you know, this is a mother, right? It's so counterintuitive to just let go, and it just finally struck me that I have tried every form of experimentation and self-deception to try and control that disease. I'm as powerless over his disease as I am over my own. And when I don't believe that, my life becomes unmanageable. I worry, I don't sleep, I don't eat, I'm nervous wreck, you know, everything's out of control, my bank account gets smaller. I'm as powerless over his disease as I am over my own. And, you know, the scary part is that we don't all make it. You know, statistically speaking, we're blessed to be here. You know, of the 100 people that need Alcoholics Anonymous, 10 will find their way into the room, 1 will stay. And those are scary odds. So I'm really, really grateful that I've gotten to stay here as long as I have, and I want to do everything I can to stay here. The fact that, you know, my child might not make it, that's just a reality I have to live with. But again, I'm powerless. I don't get to make that decision. But I have a higher power that knows what's in my best interest, knows what's in his best interest, and so I'm just going to rely on that today. I hope you got something out of that. I think we're going to get out of here early because I don't want to just ramble. But thank you again, Stan, for asking me to share.
Thank you.
Thanks, Erica. That was awesome. Give another hand.